Here's our top stories this hour. The leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement slams some Arab states' decision to normalize ties with Tel Aviv, saying such moves will never undermine Palestinians' resistance. Tehran warns against plots to incite negative sentiments toward Iran and Afghanistan between the two countries' people, saying the two nations enjoy profound historical ties. Moscow says the U.S. and Britain are helping Ukraine prepare fake claims about the alleged persecution of Ukrainian civilians in an attempt to smear Russia. Thank you for joining us. The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement has hailed the heroic acts of Palestinian youths in their fight against the Israeli regime. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said Israel's atrocities will only make Palestinians more determined in the resistance against the regime. The Hezbollah leader said the ongoing developments in Palestine will have a great impact on the struggle against Israel and the regime's future outlook. Nasrallah slammed some Arab states' decision to normalize ties with Tel Aviv. He said those who believe such moves would undermine Palestinians' resistance are deluded. He pointed to the U.S. support for Israel, saying Washington always defends aggressors and those who start wars.
We see that the United States of America continues to defend and protect the enemy that commits massacres, that launches wars, that occupies other people's lands, and even prohibits denouncing such an enemy and leave aside the fact that they prohibit and veto any resolution that would punish the Israelis, but also all the continuous wars on Palestinians and Lebanese and the people of the region and how they are dealing today.
Nasrallah also touched upon next month's parliamentary elections in Lebanon, saying surveys show that Hezbollah and its allies will win the vote. He said certain parties are misleading the Lebanese people by telling them that the resistance weapons are the cause of their problems. Nasrallah said such moves are aimed at appeasing the U.S., the West, and some Arab regimes in order to win their financial support. He said Hezbollah intends to be present in the government to prevent anyone from using the state to target the resistance or stab it in the back. The Hezbollah chief further warned against efforts made to delay the polls, accusing the U.S. Embassy in Beirut of trying to impede the electoral process. Nasrallah also called for a massive turnout in the international Quds Day rallies across the Muslim world on the last Friday of the fasting month of Ramadan as a sign of solidarity with Palestinians. Tehran has warned against plots to incite negative sentiments toward Iran and Afghanistan between the people of the two countries. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman said certain elements are seeking to foment Iranophobia and Afghan phobia through certain remarks and video clips. Said Khatibzadeh said despite such efforts, the two nations enjoy profound historical relations. He was reacting to videos posted on social media showing extremist mobs attacking the Iranian embassy in Kabul and its consulate in the eastern city of Herat. Khatibzadeh said Afghanistan's acting Taliban government is responsible for protecting foreign diplomatic missions. The spokesman said the foreign ministry is in contact with Iran's ambassador and officials of diplomatic missions in other Afghan cities to investigate the incident. The war between Russia and Ukraine is nearing its seventh week. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says his country will not halt its military operation during the next round of peace talks. Lavrov says Russia suspended military action during the first round of talks. He says Moscow will no longer pause its operation as it's convinced that Ukrainian forces will not follow suit. Meantime, Moscow says it's destroyed S-300 air defense systems supplied to Ukraine by an unidentified European country. The statement comes as Ukraine says it's bracing for a major Russian military offensive in its eastern Donbass region. The revelation has been also confirmed by the head of the self-proclaimed Donetsk Republic, who pledged to intensify operations to liberate the region. Moscow says the United States and Britain are helping Ukraine prepare fake claims about the alleged persecution of civilians in Ukraine in an attempt to smear Russia. Russia's defense ministry said the Ukrainian government was being directed by the two Western powers to show false evidence of Russian violence against civilians. The ministry says the U.S. has years of experience of organizing provocations under false pretexts. The ministry says the efforts come despite Moscow's unprecedented measures to save civilians. In recent weeks, Ukrainian troops have been showing journalists corpses of what they claim are civilians killed by Russian forces before retreating from towns and villages around the capital Kyiv. The West says the dead civilians are evidence of war crimes. Ukraine says Russia is guilty of genocide, an allegation Moscow has rejected vehemently. Russia says the possible membership of Sweden and Finland in NATO would not bring stability to Europe. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov reiterated that NATO remains a tool geared towards confrontation. He denounced the military alliance's further expansion in Europe. The possibility of accession of Sweden and Finland to NATO was raised again recently amid West's tensions with Russia over the war in Ukraine. The U.S. State Department says the prospect of the two countries joining NATO was discussed in a meeting among the alliance's foreign ministers. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg says it would be possible to admit the membership of Helsinki and Stockholm, quote, quite quickly. Russia launched a military offensive in Ukraine in late February following NATO's failure to provide Moscow with guarantees that it would bar Ukraine from becoming a member. The World Trade Organization has warned against the economic repercussions of the Ukraine war, saying the global trade growth could be shrunk by around 50% this year. Using an economic simulation model, the WTO forecast the global GDP growth could fall by 0.7 to 1.3 percentage points to hit somewhere between 3.1% and 3.7% for 2020. The model also showed the global trade growth this year could be cut almost in half from the 4.7% the WTO forecast last October to between 2.4% and 3%. The warning comes after the World Bank said the entire region would be suffering from the economic outcomes of the war in Ukraine. Boris Johnson landed in the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv, over the weekend on a surprise visit where he pledged additional British military hardware to the tune of tens of millions of pounds, as well as ramping up the anti-Russian rhetoric. British observers are now asking whether this move by Johnson will do anything other than prolonging the conflict. Amina Taylor has more from the British capital, London.
Britain has made its pro-Ukraine stance clear, with the flag of Kyiv fluttering atop several government buildings in Whitehall. Yet it was still a surprise when UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson popped up alongside Vladimir Zelensky for a walkabout in the near-deserted streets of the Ukrainian capital. The mutual political backslapping seems at odds with the reality of the crisis, but Johnson pledged further military support, including 120 armored vehicles and anti-ship missile systems.
Together with our partners, we are going to ratchet up the economic pressure, and we will continue to intensify, week by week, the sanctions on Russia. Not just freezing assets in banks and sanctioning oligarchs, but moving away from use of Russian hydrocarbons.
Back in London, the optics were not as glossy.
Well, I think Boris Johnson is engaging in a propaganda exercise designed to manufacture consent for prolonging a war, which a proxy war, that is, which is unwinnable. And rather than indulging in this sort of publicity exercise, he ought to be focusing, in my opinion, on diplomacy to bring the war to an end.
Boris Johnson has pledged further support to Kyiv in the shape of military hardware and by ramping up the anti-Russian action. It's also been mentioned that the Prime Minister might have taken this crisis as an opportunity to bolster his conflict credentials. But what of the voices urging a de-escalation and not adding fuel to this international fire? Well, many argue they won't be found here in the corridors of British power. Britain's role in the conflict, especially its supply of more armaments, has not brought the result it perhaps hoped.
Well, it doesn't help the people of Ukraine, and nor does it help the people in this country or indeed across Europe. The strategy which is being pursued by NATO is entirely counterproductive. I mean, they're heading potentially towards a wider conflagration, maybe a third world war.
At the heart of this conflict is a wider issue, one Zelensky reminded Johnson.
If we were in NATO, this war wouldn't have happened. Or it would have unfolded differently. You would have the shoulder of close neighbours, strong neighbours, or we could all fight together. And probably war would not happen.
Until real diplomacy prevails with Moscow and Kiev thrashing out their regional affairs, publicity tours like the ones undertaken by Britain's Prime Minister will only do so much. Amina Taylor, London.
Israeli forces have killed four Palestinians, including two women, in different incidents in the occupied West Bank in less than 24 hours as tensions are on the rise across the territory over the Israeli aggression. Our correspondent Mona Kandil reports from Ramallah.
Tensions have been running high in the occupied Palestinian territories, mainly in the northern West Bank city of Jenin in the last few days. Israeli forces have shot dead several Palestinians in separate incidents, including two women, in less than 24 hours. On Monday, 17-year-old Palestinian teenager Mohammed Zakarni succumbed to injuries he sustained during an Israeli military raid in Jenin. This came as Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has granted all military and security forces full freedom of operation. The Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs considered Bennett's statement as an order to kill Palestinians.
It's an order to kill. It's a war crime, actually, and a crime against humanity with the Palestinian people. Israel is trying now to escalate the situation in the occupied Palestinian territory to consolidate its apartheid and colonial regime in the occupied Palestinian territory using all the illegal measures, including the extrajudicial killing.
As Israeli forces continue raiding Jenin and the surrounding towns, Palestinian resistance groups in the city announced a state of alert and called for general mobilization of their activists to confront the Israeli military incursion. Protests have also been held across the occupied West Bank in solidarity with Jenin and its residents. Moreover, the Israeli military forces have maintained their presence across the occupied West Bank. Experts warn that they will also escalate a crackdown against Palestinians and use even more excessive force to fight the Palestinian resistance.
We are facing an escalation of events. The smell of a new intifada rises. Numerous funerals for Palestinians in several areas due to clashes taking place in friction points and sites. One can tell an escalation is expected on all fronts, which might then lead to the return of calm.
Tel Aviv has been stunned by a string of deadly operations in the last weeks. 14 Israelis, including soldiers, have been killed. Since then, tensions have risen sharply. The Israeli army has stepped up its daily raids and arrests in an attempt to crack down on the spiraling violence.
It's obvious that Tel Aviv is heading toward another heavy-handed crackdown against Palestinians in the occupied territories, and specifically in Jenin. But Palestinians who have been confronting military raids warn such crimes and escalation could, at the end of the day, set off a new intifada or popular uprising against the regime. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
In France, final results of the first round of the presidential election show incumbent Emmanuel Macron and his far-right contender Marine Le Pen would face a runoff on April the 24th. Macron won more than 27% of the votes, while Le Pen came second with over 23%. The results show a repeat of the 2017 runoff between the same candidates. However, this year, the gap between the two has become much closer. Opinion polls forecast a victory for Macron with 55% of the votes. Macron and Le Pen have campaigned on sharply opposing agenda. Le Pen has pledged radical domestic and international changes for the country, but Macron criticizes her approach as the one aligned with populists and xenophobes. He called the upcoming 2 weeks a decisive period for the future of France and Europe. Iraq has called for the dismantlement of a refugee camp controlled by U.S.-backed Kurdish militants near the Iraqi border in Syria. Baghdad says the camp, which houses thousands of Daesh terrorists, poses a real threat to Iraq's national security. The U.S. presence there, with the stated aim of eliminating Daesh terrorists, is seen by many as just a cover for Washington to maintain its illegal presence in Syria.
Al-Hawl camp is located 15 kilometers away from the Syrian-Iraqi border. It is the largest camp of Daesh elements and is controlled by the U.S.-affiliated Syrian Democratic Forces. The militants are holding tens of thousands of people in Al-Hawl camp, East Hasaka City. They run it in cooperation with U.S. occupation forces, including thousands of Daesh terrorists of different nationalities and their families, whom Washington invests and employs to implement its plans in the region. Meanwhile, Iraq's National Security Advisor, Qasem al-Araji, has expressed concern about the possibility of the release of Daesh elements and leaders from prisons controlled by U.S.-backed Kurdish militants in eastern Syria. He says Daesh has made numerous attempts to break such prisons since most of the terrorist group's leaders are incarcerated there. He has frequently met with U.S. officials and United Nations envoys to stress the need to resolve the issue of the Al-Hawl refugee camp in the northeastern Syrian province of Hasaka. The senior Iraqi official called on foreign governments to repatriate their citizens from Al-Hawl and urged a rapid dismantlement of the camp. Daesh began a terror campaign in Iraq in 2014, overrunning vast swathes in lightning attacks. Iraq declared victory over Daesh in December 2017 after a three-year counter-terrorism military campaign, which also had the support of neighboring Iran. The remnants, though, keep staging sporadic attacks across Iraq, attempting to regroup and unleash fresh violence. Daesh has intensified its terrorist attacks in Iraq since January 2020, when the United States assassinated top Iranian anti-terror commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, and deputy commander of Iraq's popular mobilization units, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandes, near Baghdad International Airport. The Iraqi anti-terror resistance groups have repeatedly warned Baghdad that the remnants of Daesh active in Syria's U.S.-occupied east may find unhindered access to the Iraqi border and infiltrate into its western Anbar province. This is while the positions of the PMU and its affiliated resistance groups operating against Daesh in the border regions have repeatedly come under attack by the U.S. military over the past years.
Well, that's your world news for now. Stay tuned.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. An investigation has found the British charity Thinking Autism promoted unproven autism treatments in testimonials on its website and directed families to clinicians linked to Andrew Wakefield, a British anti-vaccine activist, former physician and discredited academic who was struck off the medical register for his involvement in the Lancet MMR autism fraud. We're prepared for you an article written by Shanti Das. The piece is titled, Revealed, Autism Charity Chief Has Links to Anti-Vaccine Movement in UK. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. British autism charity that received hundreds of thousands of pounds in national lottery funding has links to the anti-vaccine movement and is being jointly run by a campaigner who likened the COVID-19 jab rollout to a Nazi war crime. An investigation has found Thinking Autism also promoted unproven autism treatments in testimonials on its website and directed families to clinicians linked to Andrew Wakefield, a British anti-vaccine activist, a former physician and disquieted academic who was struck off the medical register for his involvement in the Lancet MMR autism fraud. The Charity Commission said it had opened a case into the charity and was assessing evidence passed to it by The Guardian. It comes 7 years after a campaigner claims she first raised concerns about Thinking Autism with the regulator and National Lottery Community Fund. Awarded charity status in 2006, Thinking Autism claims to change lives by providing hope, emotional support, and practical information to autistic people and their families, and has received £389,750 from the Lottery Fund since 2015. It is jointly run by Joanne Allman, a vocal COVID sceptic who last year stood as a local election candidate in Sefton, Merseyside, for the Freedom Alliance, a campaigning political party born out of the pandemic to resist attacks on medical freedom and body autonomy. On social media, Joanne Allman, described in records as a trustee, treasurer and director of Thinking Autism, dismissed the Omicron variant in a post on Facebook in November of 2021, and last month reshared a post on Twitter calling the vaccine rollout a reckless, dangerous, insane experiment. In other posts, Joanne Allman said PCR testing was a fraud underlying the greatest hoax in medical history and tweeted that people the world over were being coerced into having an experimental vaccine. Alongside a picture of the Nuremberg trials held after the Second World War to bring Nazi war criminals to justice, she wrote, "How long will we have to wait before those who are complicit in tyranny are brought to justice for crimes against humanity?" While those posts were from Joanne Allman's personal accounts, campaigners expressed safeguarding concerns for vulnerable families seeking help from Thinking Autism, which hosts conferences, online events and runs a private Facebook group. The charity itself has publicly been largely quiet on COVID-related issues, aside from announcing its opposition to vaccine passports. But it has a history of promoting misinformation dating back to at least 2014, when it shared a video in support of research by Andrew Wakefield, who was struck off the medical register for a discredited study claiming vaccines were linked to autism. Its website, meanwhile, carries testimonials for unproven autism treatments, including homeopathy and cease therapy, a pseudo-scientific approach that claims to remove supposed toxic effects from outside sources, including vaccines. Campaigner Emma Dalmain, who runs Autistic Inclusive Meets, a non-profit organisation that advocates for autistic people, said she first reported concerns about the charity's promotion of unproven treatments to the Charity Commission and the National Lottery Community Fund back in 2015. She questioned why it was still operating 7 years later. She said, "The Charity Commission is potentially putting vulnerable children at risk by lending credibility to organizations like Thinking Autism." Michael Marshall, project director at the Good Thinking Society, which campaigns against pseudoscience, said, "It was extremely troubling to see people linked to the charity trying to undermine efforts to curb the spread of COVID-19. Michael Marshall added, "If they cannot understand the importance of public health measures and cannot refrain from baseless scaremongering about vaccines, they should not be in a position where their misinformed opinions may put children in harm's way." Meanwhile, Thinking Autism has said members of the charity were free to hold their own views and that it endorsed the rights of autistic people and their families to speak about their healthcare experiences. It said it heard from hundreds of families each year thanking it for its support. It said the charity does not endorse any specific view except that people with autism who are suffering from healthcare problems deserve appropriate investigations and treatments. "Because healthcare is an individual and personal choice, and because we are not medical professionals but rather parent volunteers, we're explicitly clear on our website and social media that information we provide should not be construed as medical advice." Joanne Allman said the posts were made from her personal social media accounts and did not make references to autism. She said, "My personal opinions on COVID-related issues have no bearing on my role as a director and trustee of Thinking Autism." The Charity Commission said it had opened a compliance case relating to concerns raised about Thinking Autism, including the charity's use of social media, and was currently engaging with the trustees. It said it had no record of a 2015 complaint. The National Lottery Committee Fund, which allocates money raised by the lottery to community groups and charities, said its funding relationship with Thinking Autism reached its conclusion in 2020. In relation to the 2015 complaint, the National Lottery Community Fund said, "We looked into it and were satisfied that the funding was being used in line with the agreed proposal."
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the All Beneficent, the All Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Within the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Shaykh Ali Himani and Shaykh Qasim. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me on the show.
So for today's discussion, we want to talk about college education. How essential is it? I mean, university and college education. And do we need at all a college education or not? You know, nowadays, the case of self-study, without going to the college, because, you know, you can find the teaching courses on different materials online.
Even the videos
and all of that. So a person can be sitting in the house, you know, looking at them and finding them without going to the university. But this degree-based lifestyle you know, just getting to the... Because whenever you are going to apply for a job, the first question that they ask in your CV, resume, that's right, is your education. You know, what is your education and degree? And from the other side, we had some exceptions during the history that they become great people. But when they left the university or left, for example, the official formal education. But I still think that this college education has a role in shaping the human personality. Because till that time, you do not know what you want to do for your future. But upon a chance or a random checking of a specific major at the university, which is mostly done without interest at that age, your whole life will be changed into a doctor or an engineer or a physicist or a chemist or something like that, okay?
Or a materialist.
Or a materialist or something like that. I do want to say what to do to guide our desires, I mean, in pursuing knowledge or in pursuing a specific science.
Yeah,
actually, is there at all a way or no? We have to.
Yeah, for sure. Again, I have to reemphasize on the fact that we have. I know we have to take these two sides simultaneously. So, having the line of education, the college education or the classic education that we take. On one side, and on the other side, the knowledge, especially the spiritual knowledge or the religious knowledge that we have to have. On the other side, we have to grow both of them simultaneously. Mm-hmm. But what I want to say is that I believe that the reason that he asked the question, the previous question, and the answer that the Sheikh Kadhim, Sheikh Ali gave. Was that, we see some people that get, frustrated not going to colleges and universities because of not having enough money or, not having enough time or any, they're not capable of going to colleges for any reason. So is it the end of the world for them not going to college or not? I believe that, these universities and colleges, maybe the most important thing that you can get out of this college or university is a sort of certificate or a sort of reassurance that this person is skillful and is is enoughly learned to do that job. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So for example, neuroscientist or neurosurgeon. So that certificate that you get, that degree that you get, it shows that you are qualified for doing surgery or things like that.
Okay.
But if you can get that that trustworthiness from somewhere else, like showing yourself that you're skillful at that job. That again, can suffice. For example, yeah, for sure, for some jobs, we cannot have a person that who claims that I'm a surgeon.
I have certain problem with this new but world order, engineer,
No, but with an engineer. So okay. Again, I want to quote what you yourself said, yes. That, we have many giants in the science,
yes,
that have not passed, maybe the higher education, yes, sometimes. But they prove that they are worthy of being, a scientist.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay.
This is what I mean. So, I believe that the skill is at the core of everything. So that certificate that the college or university gives you is a sort of insurance, the reinsurance, and, a proof for that skill that you may have. So
that's
if you can prove that skill that you have in another way, other than having the certificate or having that degree,
mm-hmm,
that is worthy again. So, yeah.
Again, I've got this problem with this world. I mean, is that all human being was created for such, aim? I mean, to have past courses. This is a big philosophical, ontological question about.
Correct.
The very...
But before going there, yes, let me just clarify a couple of points, what Sheikh Kasim has mentioned here. True that skill plays a very vital role, but there are certain skills which are high-risk skills. Like, for example, someone who can drop out of school and learn programming, mm-hmm, by himself, mm-hmm, all by himself, and then go out and present and then, you know, show the code that, look, I wrote this code and this is what is the outcome, and I'm able to do that without necessarily having to go to college. And that's okay. He's able to establish his credibility there. But there are certain skills where the life of people depend on that. Yeah, sure. And that is where, even if you show that, you look, I can, you know, perform a surgery on surgery of the brain or the heart because I worked with an ex-doctor and all that, people will find it difficult to trust on you until unless they really see that you're a well-educated person and all that. So I think we need to categorize these areas into different fields where there are high-risk areas and there are low-risk areas. In the low-risk areas, in all the areas, skills play the vital role. But in the low-risk area, people will find it easy to trust on you and allow you to access their car or their AC or their washing machine and even computer, hardware, software. Because the risk there is just the financial risk, not the risk of the life.
So the issue is the credibility.
The credibility and the amount of risk that is being placed here. You know, if I know that a particular doctor is specialized pediatrician who knows the in and outs of children's problems, I can go to him. Right, but I know that there's a doctor who's you know, world number one, but he's not a pediatrician. I would be worried to take my son or daughter to him because I know that he knows the in and out, but he doesn't know how the system for the children work. Right, so I think there are areas that we need to categorize that these are high risk areas. This is where I don't think people will compromise, even if I promote the idea that skill is important. But people, they will not compromise on these areas. So I think we can categorize and say that certain areas, it's okay if you don't go. Even if you're a dropout, you can learn by yourself. But certain areas definitely need that specialization.
Yeah, I'm
so
going back
what
to...
about past that the college education was not there?
What about?
What about the past that the college university education was not there as the official thing? There were some learnings, but the people lived long. The people lived better than today. You know, I think the lifestyle was good. Of course, there have been some diseases and the pandemics killed so many people. But I don't think that, for example, degree at the college or university helped the people in order to have a more prosperous life, in quotes, you know, in both this world and the other world.
Yeah, the expectation of people has raised, you know, during these years, maybe 200 years, since 200 years till now. So, yeah, maybe before it was like the way that you described, but nowadays, you know, as the brother mentioned, you know, again, I have to emphasize under the credibility. So those high risk, professions. There's the credibility is not built there. So, you know, because for example, if a person you encounter a person that is not that you're not sure that this person is skillful in that area or not, you're not going to give him, you know, the job that you have.
Okay.
But before, I know in the past, it was not like that. You know, the expectation of people was not like that, because the knowledge was not that developed at that time. So if there was a person, I don't know who could do even a stand of things to do, you know, he would be respected a lot. You know, even a nurse would be respected, like a physician is respected. But now the expectation is high. But I want to go back to the question that you asked in the early question that you had. That, is there any sort of conflict between the knowledge and science? Is it our goal just to go for, you know, science, or the other way around? Is it our goal just to go for, you know, knowledge and, you know, spiritual knowledge and Islamic teachings, for example? I think, again, I have to say that there is no conflict here. Both of them are valued in Islam, but one thing has to be taken into consideration, which is everything that you do in your life has to be for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and for the prosperity of you and the human beings, in both in this life and the life to come. And I want to, make use of this actually opportunity that I have to ask our brothers and sisters who are listening to this, that even though, for example, I don't know, they are doing their education in, I don't know, in medicine or in engineering or whatever they're doing, software, whatever.
Yes.
They try their best to do ikhlas in those things, you know,
yes.
Because they would reach at an age where they see and look back, you know, and say, you know, they have everything, they have money, they have, you know, everything. But they, you know, and they are good people, they are, yes, you know, Muslims, good Muslims. Yeah. But unfortunately, what they have done is not based on ikhlas and, you know, for the sake of Allah subhanahu, yes, wa ta'ala. So they try to, you know, to purify their intention for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and for serving the religion of Islam and the,
yes,
school of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wassalam.
Okay. And how much your job, your occupation, the university major, the college that you are studying, helps you to promote yourself. You know, this is good. Okay, you might be an expert in a specific field of study, but when you cannot interact with the people outside, you use foul language, you cannot act in a proper way in a society, what type of knowledge or education it might be? I think the higher education is very much higher than the college and the university, but the college and university, if it is mingled with practice, I mean skill, on that time it would be great, but the mere degree, unfortunately, does not help anyone. And I think today's world is very much looking for the degrees.
Not necessarily. No. People are looking for the skill. So I might have 5 degrees, but I don't know how to work, okay, how to solve a problem, how to run a business, how to manage a department. Mm-hmm. Then they say, Baba, okay, I don't care even if you have 10 degrees or you're a, mm-hmm, Nobel Prize winner, but if, yes, you can't get the things done, we don't need you.
That's right. Okay. Thank you, Sheikh Qasim, yeah, and Sheikh Ali Himani for your presence in the program. Viewpoints, it was very kind of you. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en/islampage. Also, our YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I wanna have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know that amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong in a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In the US, despite concluding that it has enough evidence, the January 6th House panel is concerned that making a referral to the Justice Department would backfire by politicizing the investigation into the Capitol riot. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Michael Schmidt, Luke Broadwater and Maggie Haberman. The piece is titled, "January 6th Panel Has Evidence for Criminal Referral of Trump, but Splits on Sending." The leaders of the House committee investigating the Capitol attack have grown divided over whether to make a criminal referral to the Justice Department of former President Donald J. Trump, even though they have concluded that they have enough evidence to do so, people involved in the discussions have said. The debate centers on whether making a referral, a largely symbolic act, would backfire by politically tainting the Justice Department's expanding investigation into the 6th of January assault and what led up to it. Since last summer, a team of former federal prosecutors working for the committee has focused on documenting the attack and the preceding efforts by Donald Trump and his allies to reverse his defeat in the 2020 presidential election. The panel plans to issue a detailed report of its findings, but in recent months it has regularly signaled that it was also weighing a criminal referral that would pressure Attorney General Merrick Garland to open a criminal investigation into former President Donald J. Trump. Despite concluding that they have enough evidence to refer Mr. Trump for obstructing a congressional proceeding and conspiring to defraud the American people, some on the committee are questioning whether there is any need to make a referral to the Justice Department. The Justice Department appears to be ramping up a wide-ranging investigation, and making a referral could saddle a criminal case with further partisan baggage at a time when Donald Trump is openly flirting with running again in 2024. The committee's vice chairwoman, Representative Liz Cheney, said on CNN on Sunday, 10th of April, that the committee had not reached a final decision about making referrals and downplayed any divisions on the committee, but acknowledged there was significant evidence of criminality. "I think that it is absolutely the case. It is absolutely clear that what President Trump was doing, what a number of people around him were doing, that they knew it was unlawful. They did it anyway," said Liz Cheney, a Wyoming Republican. The shift in committee leaders' perspective on making a referral was prompted in part by a ruling 2 weeks ago by Judge David Carter of the Federal District Court for Central California, deciding a civil case in which the committee had sought access to more than 100 emails written by John Eastman, a lawyer who advised Donald Trump on efforts to derail certification of the Electoral College outcome. Judge David Carter found that it was more likely than not that Mr. Trump and Mr. Eastman had committed federal crimes. The ruling led some committee and staff members to argue that even though they felt they had amassed enough evidence to justify calling for a prosecution, the judge's decision would carry far greater weight with Merrick Garland, Attorney General Merrick Garland, than any referral letter they could write, according to people with knowledge of their conversations. The members and aides who were reluctant to support a referral contended that making one would create the appearance that Merrick Garland was investigating Donald Trump at the behest of a Democratic Congress, and that if the committee could avoid that perception, it should do so. Even if the final report does not include a specific referral letter to Attorney General Merrick Garland, the findings would still provide federal prosecutors with the evidence the committee uncovered, including some that has not yet become public, that could be used as a roadmap for any prosecution, the people said. "If you read his decision, I think it's quite telling," Representative Zoe Lofgren, Democrat of California and a member of the House panel, said of Judge David Carter's ruling. Zoe Lofgren added, "He and we have reviewed a huge amount of documents, and he reached a conclusion that he outlined in very stark terms. Zoe Lofgren is among those who believe a referral letter to the Justice Department is superfluous, since it would carry no legal weight. Maybe we will, maybe we won't, she said of a referral. It doesn't have a legal impact. But the question about whether to send a referral has, for one of the first times since the committee was formed in July, exposed differences among the committee's members. Representative Elaine Luria, Democrat of Virginia and a member of the House panel, said that the committee should still send a referral for any crimes it uncovers. It would say that I don't agree with what some of my colleagues have said about this, Ms. Luria said on MSNBC this month. I think it's a lot more important to do what's right than it is to worry about the political ramifications. This committee, our purpose is legislative and oversight, but if in the course of our investigation we find that criminal activity has occurred, I think it's our responsibility to refer that to the US Justice Department. Liz Cheney portrayed any divisions as minor and said the panel would work collaboratively and reach a consensus agreement. I'm confident we will work to come to an agreement, she said. Although staff members have been in discussion about a referral and some have debated the matter publicly, the committee members have not sat down together to discuss whether to proceed with a referral, several lawmakers have said. Representative Pete Aguilar, Democrat of California, said the committee was likely to hold off on making a final determination until investigators finished their work. He said the House panel was finishing up its investigative phase and shifting to a more public-facing one in which the panel will present its findings. The members haven't had those conversations, Mr. Aguilar said, of a meeting to discuss a potential referral. Right now, we're gathering the material that we need. As the investigative phase winds down, we'll have more conversations about what the report looks like, but we're not presupposing whether that's going to go before we get a little further with the interviews. Although the committee has the ability to subpoena testimony and documents and make referrals to the U.S. Justice Department for prosecutions, it has no criminal prosecution powers of its own. Liz Cheney singled out Donald Trump's conduct at a public hearing in December, reading from the criminal code and laying out how she believed he had obstructed Congress. In early March, the committee in effect road-tested whether the evidence it had gathered could support a prosecution, laying out in a filing in the civil case before Judge David Carter its position that Donald Trump and John Eastman had obstructed Congress and defrauded the American public. In validating the committee's position, legal experts said the judge made it difficult for the U.S. Justice Department to avoid an investigation. Attorney General Merrick Garland has given no public indication of the department's intentions other than to say that it will follow the facts and the law. But subpoenas issued by a federal grand jury indicate that prosecutors are gathering information about a wide array of issues, including about efforts to obstruct the election certification by people in the Trump White House and in Congress. Investigators from the House Committee and the U.S. Justice Department have not been sharing information, except to avoid conflicts around the scheduling of certain witnesses. We want them to move faster, but we respect their work, Mr. Aguilar, Democrat of California, said, adding that the committee has a different goal than that the Justice Department's inquiry. To fully investigate what led to the riot, which injured more than 150 police officers, and take legislative steps to prevent a repeat. It's an insult to the lives of the Capitol Police officers if we don't pursue what happened and take meaningful and concrete steps to ensure that it doesn't happen again. Aside from the question of whether to make a referral about Donald Trump, the committee has moved aggressively to use the Justice Department to ensure that witnesses cooperate with its investigation. The committee has met criminal referrals against four Trump White House officials for their refusal to sit for questioning or hand over documents, accusing them of contempt of Congress. But the Justice Department has charged only one individual, Steve Bannon, frustrating the committee. Those frustrations played out in public at a hearing this month when Zoe Lofgren said, "This committee is doing its job. The Department of Justice needs to do theirs." Ms. Lofgren said she had not planned to make the remarks, but as she sat on the days during the hearing, she decided to veer from her planned remarks because the department's slowness in addressing the contempt referrals ate at her. "Some of us did express some frustration. I'm among them," she said. "Honestly, I hadn't planned to say that. It wasn't my script. It wasn't there. But I thought, you know, this is frustrating. I just decided to say it." Trying to pressure the Justice Department to prosecute a contempt of Congress charge is more appropriate than other criminal referrals, Zoe Lofgren argued. "It's different than doing a referral generally for prosecution," she said. "When you're the victim of a crime, there is some weight to that. And when you are the victim of a criminal contempt, as the committee is, you're the victim. And so I think there was some stature to that." The committee is preparing to hold public hearings in May and June and to make a final report this September. After interviewing more than 800 witnesses, including more than a dozen Trump White House officials, the panel has another 100 interviews lined up, including some witnesses it wants to bring in a second time. Among those scheduled to testify soon is Stephen Miller, a former White House advisor to Donald Trump, who the committee says helped spread false claims of voter fraud in the election and encouraged state legislatures to appoint alternate slates of electors in an effort to invalidate Joseph R. Biden Jr.'s election victory.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.